And now it's time for On Our Minds. Cosmology is on our minds this week with a remarkable new discovery confirming the Big Bang and the inflationary theory of the universe. Why does it matter? Because the creation stories we tell, like the Big Bang, fundamentally shape our sense of ourselves. Steve Paulson talks about this with Adam Frank. He's an astrophysicist who writes for NPR's science blog, 13.7, and he's the author of the book About Time, Cosmology and Culture at the Twilight of the Big Bang.
You start off your book by saying the Big Bang is all but dead, which I think will surprise a lot of people who consider this the reigning explanation for the origins of the universe. So why do you say the Big Bang is dead?
Well, I think the key point is your use of the word origins. The Big Bang is a wonderful explanation for what happened after the origin. So what the Big Bang essentially does is it presents you with a roadmap for the evolution of the universe starting at, you know, this is perhaps a little bit debatable, but, you know, certainly after about a millionth of a second after the moment of creation, the Big Bang does an exquisite job and an exquisitely well-documented job in terms of the relationship to data at explaining how atoms and molecules formed, how those turned into clumps of gas that became galaxies, et cetera, et cetera, leading to what we see today.
So you're saying the science goes back to about a millionth of a second after the actual creation, but the creation itself is beyond the science that at least that we have today.
Well, what's happened is, you know, we've been pushing further and further back. The more we learn about the internal constitution of matter, this is what we do in those giant particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider in Europe. But the actual moment itself, that has always remained a fundamental mystery shrouded in what we call a singularity.
So it sounds like you're saying it's not that the Big Bang is wrong. It's just that it's incomplete and it has nothing to say about the actual absolute beginning.
Exactly. And so in order to go further, to go back to the beginning or to understand what happened before the Big Bang, the all-important question of was there a beginning at all, physicists have had to push against the governing equations as they understand them, the equations of general relativity, which is Einstein's theory for gravity, and the theories of quantum physics, which describe matter at its smallest domains. And basically, those equations do not talk to each other. General relativity is not a quantum theory. And so people have been searching for theories of quantum gravity. And because of that, it's led them into a complete wild west of theorizing that in many cases make the Big Bang, the idea of an origin itself, irrelevant, that you don't need a Big Bang at all. There's a number of ideas, things like the multiverse or string theory, or even wilder ideas that sort of push against the idea of there being a beginning.
Of course, the whole idea of the Big Bang, at least the way I had always heard about it, was that there was nothing before the Big Bang.
Exactly.
This was the moment that space and time started, and before that, there was nothing.
Right.
And you're saying that there are a lot of cosmologists now saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there was something before. In fact, maybe there are all these other universes out there, and the Big Bang popped out of something else.
Right. This idea of does the universe have a beginning? Has the universe always existed? Will it always exist? Has been around since the age of myth, essentially. And so with the Big Bang, we just oscillated over to one version of an answer to that, that the universe just started and there was nothing before, which, you know, people sort of said, oh, look, this just sounds like Genesis. And now what we're finding as we push harder against the science is perhaps we should be moving back to the other pole in the answer to that question, which is that the universe always did exist. But of course, with science, you can't just sort of say that. You have to sort of understand, you have to build the mathematical framework to embrace the data. And through that, people now are coming to these what may be very interesting and sometimes crazy sounding ideas, like there's infinite numbers of universes that are all parallel to each other, or that there's more dimensions than we can possibly see. The universe may have, you know, 10 spatial dimensions rather than the three that we just exist with, that we're used to seeing.
So why does this matter? I mean, to other than astrophysicists who obsess over these things, for just ordinary people, does it matter whether the science has some explanation about how everything started?
Well, the remarkable answer to that question is yes, it matters profoundly. It's really about time. It's about how we experience time, how we organize time, how we shape our days through time. Think about when the clock was first introduced into Europe around the 1300s. If you asked somebody in, say, you know, 500 AD, what time is it? They sort of tell you, well, lunch. You know, that was about as good as it got. There were no clocks. Clocks did not appear until 1300, and when they did, they swept through Europe. Within 100 years, every town in Europe has a clock in it.
So the clock basically meant that everyone could agree on the same time, whereas before, that possibility didn't exist.
Exactly. And people didn't need it, essentially, right? The culture had not evolved to the point that it was necessary for everybody to have that kind of accuracy. You moved by the, you know, the movement of the sun. And, you know, that sort of sets the boundary conditions or initial conditions for human life, right? The sun comes up, the sun goes down. But needing a much more accurate and universally agreed upon division of the day was not something that occurred until the beginning of modern Europe, as trade and commerce really began to take off in the 13 and 1400s. That was when culture needed a time that was more exact.
Didn't some of the first clocks actually come out of the early European monasteries?
Yes. The monasteries were really the one place in Europe, in the European culture after the fall of Rome in the Western Empire, that some kind of time discipline, more rigorous time discipline, was needed.
Which is fascinating when you think about it, because you'd think the monasteries would be, I don't know, maybe more interested in sacred time, God's time, rather than the time of how to get through the day.
Well, in the beginning, it was God's time. You know, the reason why they were interested in or they needed those divisions was because to keep the hours, the canonical hours, which were essentially the different types of prayer that they had to, you know, that they moved through the day. But then what happened is once this clock, once the clocks made it out into the broader culture, you very quickly see the clock being used as a metaphor for the universe, right? It's only about 100 years after the introduction of clocks that you start hearing the clockwork universe.
Wasn't that Isaac Newton's big idea?
Well, it was Nicolas Ormsay who first that term actually got out into the culture. And then, yes, Newton's version, Newton's radical invention in time, right, his reimagining of time was to imagine that time was God's clock. And that's what he used to build his laws of physics. And they became the basis for the Industrial Revolution's machines.
And of course, at a certain point, you didn't just have clocks. You had the breakdown of the day into hours and minutes. When was the hour invented?
Well, the hours, actually, there was this big debate. Once clocks became part of European culture, in the beginning it was bells. They were just tolling units, essentially. By 1400, you saw that sort of being locked in. And then that abstraction, and when the bell strikes one, that's when you go back to work, right? When the bell strikes five, that's when you're allowed to leave work. Minutes, however, minutes do not appear until the end of the 1700s. Why? Well, in some sense, we didn't need them, right? You know, nobody experienced a minute beforehand because the culture didn't need it. But once you started having machines based on Newtonian physics that moved very rapidly, right? You had the first industrial machines spinning, you know, 1,000 times a second or hundreds of times a second, being able to stamp out small pieces of metal, maybe 50 or 60 of those in an hour or so, or even less. Suddenly, minutes began to matter. So there's this very tight coupling between the ability to mark minutes with your clock and your use for them.
It's fascinating to think about how this actually affects daily life and how we experience time. Because, I mean, it's so hard to sort of imagine a situation that's different than our own, a culture
right.
That's different. And, you know, I'm sort of trying to think, you know, so how much was life different in the 1300s or the 1400s, which had invented this idea of the 24-hour day, as opposed to the 1700s, which then had broken the day down into minutes? I mean, were these radically different experiences of time?
Oh, absolutely. I think people were essentially living in a different world then, truly a different world. And if you want a sort of modern equivalent of this, I mean, some people will be able to understand this. Cell phones have really radically changed the way we just sort of move through the day, right? I watch my students, the bell rings, they all get up, they walk outside to the quad, and instantly the cell phone is out and they're talking to each other like, hey, man, what are you doing? I don't know. What are you doing? Right? This, we can't take a walk by ourselves without sort of pulling out that cell phone or, you know, checking our email. This is the way we, you know, through our technology, the way we experience time and move through the day. Imagine if you were going to go from point A to point B, there were no trains, you probably didn't own a horse, you were going to have to walk. And it was going to take perhaps 4 or 5 hours to walk from one town to the next.
So is there a connection then between this speeded up time that we experience in our daily lives? I mean, the fact that we have all these electronic gadgets now and we're instantly in touch with the whole world around us and this debate about the Big Bang and all these great cosmological questions?
Oh, I think there's a very deep connection in them. Let's just go back a little bit to sort of think about how we got to the Big Bang. There was another transition around the turn of the last century, you know, the 1900s, that was just as important for the development of time and cosmology. And that was, on one hand, Einstein, and on the other hand, the development of trains and telegraphs and radio. Both of them affected time quite deeply. And one of the interesting things that happens around 1850 or so, 1860 and 1870, trains radically alter people's experience of time in a number of ways. But one of the best ways to illustrate this is that it used to be that New York, say, and Philadelphia had their own time. You know, their version of noon was different from Philadelphia's version of noon. You know, in 1790, it didn't matter because it took a day and a half to get from Philadelphia to New York. But by 1890, it does matter because now trains are getting you there in 3 hours. So you may now suddenly want to leave New York on the 12:05 and get into Philadelphia at the 3:05 and be ready for a 3:30 appointment. And if those two towns have different measures of noon, you know, if they're off by 5 or 10 minutes, everything falls apart. So people needed to think about now, right? The idea of simultaneity. Now, Albert Einstein comes along, right, with his radical ideas, and those radical ideas were essentially about simultaneity. And where did these develop? Partially, they developed when he was working at the patent office in Switzerland. His assignment was to work on patents for electromechanical devices that could determine simultaneity. Hmm. And so there is a beautiful example of the overlap. Einstein develops this new theory of the universe, which allows the Big Bang to exist. But Einstein, some of his deepest thinking was influenced by the patents he was working on for developing new machines that his culture needed. So there is a very nice example of how the cultural questions and the cosmological questions braid together in a way that is really inseparable. And that is, I would argue, exactly what is happening today as we develop these new digital technologies and how at the same time they stress the cultural conceptions of time and are pushing us to develop new ones.
Adam Frank is an astrophysicist at the University of Rochester. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his book, About Time.